Hi everyone, my name is Sheila Besic and I'm currently in my last year of a commercial technician class, and I welcome you to the very first episode of the International Law for Peace podcast. Our project is all about international law and humanitarian law, where we would like to discuss certain subjects that are on the latest news, such as this one, and our main goal is to educate you and ourselves for a better understanding of international laws and rights. So also joined with me today is my teacher, and he's just going to introduce himself.
Hello, Sheila. Glad to be here. Thank you for asking. My name is Kevin Simon. I'm a teacher in EduC, and I'm helping Sheila to do this podcast.
So let's start. So as with almost everything to do with this conflict, it depends on whom you ask. Others will start with the late 19th century Jewish migration to what was then the Ottoman Empire and the rise of Zionism. Zionism is, by definition, a Jewish nationalist movement that has had as its goal the creation and support of a Jewish national state, as in this case in Palestine. So, when was the whole starting point to this conflict?
Well, in fact, you could start in antiquity, but today we start with the United Nations vote in 1947. In fact, the idea was to partition the land, which was ruled or governed by British, called the British Mandate of Palestine. And the idea was to divide this region into two states, one Jewish and one Arab. But neither the Palestinians nor the neighboring Arab countries accepted this founding of modern Israel. And, well, Israel, as we know today, is an independent country, and it declared that independence in May 1948. At that time, about 700,000 Palestinians were expelled, or they fled, and in total it's about 85% of the Arab population of that territory captured by Israel during what is the aftermath of that Declaration of Independence, War of Independence. And, most of these Palestinians never returned or were never allowed to return to their country, to those territories where they lived before. And the Palestinians therefore called that the Nakba, which translates into catastrophe, and that remains today the most dramatic event in their modern history.
So what happened to the Palestinians that wanted to stay, or they chose to stay in their country?
Well, in fact, those Arabs who remained in Israel, they became citizens, but they were also subject to official discrimination. There was a difference between Israeli inhabitants of the country and Arab citizens. The Arabs were placed under military rule for almost two decades, roundabout, and that military discrimination deprived them of many basic civil rights. They were also treated as cheap labor source, practically majorly manual labor.
So that basically means they were refugees in their own country.
Yes, in fact, you could say that.
So I know a lot of people have the same question. Was there ever a peace solution by both sides? I mean, how did it even come to this point? Was there ever any agreements on both sides? How did it come this far?
In fact, there were ideas, there were great good steps towards a peaceful solution, which was in fact accepted by both sides. We started in 1993 with the Oslo Accords that were signed between representatives of Israel and representatives of Palestine. But the things that were written in the Oslo Accords never came to pass. They were never realized. And, 30 years ago, in fact, the leaders of Israel and Palestine met in the United States on the lawn of the White House, and many believed at that time that the Oslo Accords signed back then could be a start to a peaceful resolution of the conflict. But as we know today, it never came to be, never happened. In fact, the Oslo Accords had the idea that two states would be created on the territory, which was the British Mandate. One for the Israel, for Israel, which we have now, and one for the Palestinians, with the idea that both people had the right of self-determination and to have a nation for themselves. So the idea to have a Palestinian and an Israel state next to each other. There were several steps taken. The military of Israel had to withdraw from several occupied territories. On the other hand, the Palestinians agreed to recognize Israel as a state, which they had not done until then. And the main body doing that was the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, a political party recognized by Western and countries in the world as a whole. The thing is that there were other groups like the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad who did not agree with that two-state solution and who said that there was no real means to realize it without harming or discriminating the Palestinians. So, in fact, what do we know? How did Palestine become occupied?
So Israel launched in 1967 a defensive war against Jordan, Egypt, and Syria, and the attack caught Arab governments by surprise, and Israel achieved rapid victories, including seizing the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip from Egypt, the Golan Heights from Syria, and the West Bank and East Jerusalem from Jordan. The Six-Day War was a military success for Israel, and its capture of all of Jerusalem and newly acquired control over the biblical lands called Judea and Samaria opened the way to the construction of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, which became central to the conflict. Israel placed the Arab population of the West Bank under military rule, which is enforced to this day.
Was it then a breaking point for the Palestinians? Did they do anything about the oppression?
So yes, that illusion was shattered in 87 as young Palestinians rose up. The uprising was marked by mass stone throwing and the Israeli army responded with large-scale arrests and collective punishments. The first Intifada, which basically means uprising or rebellion, was a largely spontaneous series of Palestinian demonstrations, non-violent actions like mass boycotts and refusing to work jobs in Israel. Palestinian fatalities dramatically outpaced Israeli ones as the Israeli military responded to the protests and attacks with heavy force. The second uprising was markedly different from the first Intifada because of widespread suicide bombings against Israel civilians launched by Hamas. Hamas is an Islamist militant movement and it governs more than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of countries see Hamas as a terrorist organization, though some apply this label to its military ring, the unit of command. And other groups and the scale of Israeli military retaliation. The second and far bloodier Intifada grew out of the collapse of the peace process in 2000. Negotiations between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and PLO chairman Yasser Arafat broke down, and the Intifada began shortly afterwards. The central cause was likely a basic mistrust between the two sides that made war inevitable after peace talks broke down. Although no single event signaled its end, most analysts agreed that it had run its course by late 2005. The two uprisings resulted in the death of more than 5,000 Palestinians and 1,400 Israelis. So I would like to discuss where Israel and Palestine are now, because it has been a lot in the news, and I think a lot of people have questions about it. So I would just like to ask you from your perspective, why do you think it came to this point?
Well, in fact, many Western countries just did really nothing concrete in order to realize this two-stage solution that was, in fact, agreed upon in the Oslo Accords, mm-hmm. as we have seen. And well, there are many other factors, and I would like to point out one, which is, of course, very important then. The Benjamin Netanyahu, who is actually right now Prime Minister of Israel, has been for a long time, for several years now. And, Well, in fact, there have been many actions taken by Israeli governments over those years that have in fact, undermined the Oslo Accords. So There is not really a solution or a way of a solution which is underway in order to realize the two-stage solution, to put it into action and, well, give every people their country, their own country.
So, you know, on the news, people always talk about how the 7th of October was a really, I don't know how to really label it, a disastrous situation. Obviously, mm-hmm. a lot of people have died, but there have been also a lot of protests all around the world. And do you think that both sides are viewed right in the media? Are both sides rightly represented in the media?
It's a difficult question to answer.
Yes, it is.
Being labeling what are judging the media right or wrong is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. As we know, and that's my very own opinion on this matter, the world isn't black and white. Mm-hmm. The thing is, media often paint it in black and white, mm-hmm. with a bad guy and a good guy on opposite sides, respectively. But there's very, very much gray in between. And personally, I believe that the Hamas is, as they are Palestinians, they are Arab, but it's a very own small party, a very own small group within this whole. Mm-hmm. And judging a people for the actions of a small group isn't right.
I agree.
Painting Palestinians as terrorists in general isn't correct, mm-hmm. just by that. But there are people who want to achieve their goals by through violence. And that, on the other hand, is the wrong mm-hmm. way. There should be negotiations, there should be diplomatic ways peacefully mm-hmm. to resolve the conflict, which were based on the Oslo Accords, which could be based there. On the other hand, we have seen that the Israeli governments, especially over the last years now, have done little to achieve that solutions on their mm-hmm. part. Mm-hmm. So, in conclusion, I'd say that while the terrorist attacks, the violence is on both sides, is not necessary, not needed, not welcome, we should hear the voices that are speaking for a peaceful solution, which exist on both sides.
So I totally agree with your statement. I think it's very, very sad and heartbreaking to see on both sides people dying, especially children, because most of the Palestinian population is children. And I think it's very gut-wrenching to see it on the media. And I think after so many years of conflict and so many years of trying to find a peaceful solution, it's very, very heartbreaking. And I don't know how to really put it, but it breaks the heart of millions of people to not see a two-state solution. I would hope and love to see a two-state solution, but I don't think that neither sides are ready to have a peaceful discussion just yet. And I also agree that putting the Palestinians as a whole into Hamas, to basically that Hamas represents them, I think it's very, very wrong. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, most of the Palestinians that have died are men, women, and mostly children.
Civilians.
Exactly, just peaceful civilians trying to live their everyday lives. So, I don't know, it's a very sensitive subject. And I would just like to see in the future, maybe to see more, to see both sides being represented better. Because I do think, as of what I've seen, that the media does like to prefer one side of the other. But I think it's fair to represent both sides equally. Because I do think that one group does not represent a whole nationality. That's basically my opinion on the whole conflict. So would you like to add anything?
I'd add one thing, just because you were talking about children. Mm-hmm. And this rises, or how should I put it? It gives the conflict a large scale meaning.
Yeah.
It's not something that's resolved in one generation. I mean, those Palestinian children we have now have lived there their whole lives. They have no other situation, or the adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
Same for Israeli children, Israeli adults. They have no other situation than the like we have now. Mm-hmm. They have also always these tensions, these conflicts, these terrorist attacks, oppression, etc. There's no end to it right now, and they see no end.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, media on one side, which is favored to Israel, paints a different story, paints a different picture than one rather in favor of the Palestinian side. So, in fact, what we should have is a worldwide solution. Right now, with the conflict I'm not quite sure with whether both sides are capable mm-hmm. of finding a way
exactly.
to communicate and to find a solution, which yeah. would benefit them both.
Yeah. So I also just think that at the end of the day, we're all humans. We all bleed the same.
Yep.
And I don't think it's really a religion conflict. I just really think that it's who gets to have more territory, which I also do think it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Because I could imagine both sides living in a two-state, like a two-state solution. I think that it has been a catastrophe. But I really hope for both sides that for one day they get to live together. Either it would be the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims. I don't know. Living a peaceful life sounds fair and good.
So sounds very, as you say, it sounds very fair and good, nice, and hopefully it's possible to achieve it one day. And I hope the world pulls together on this for once.
Yeah.
And that those who do wrong are being held accountable for it.
Exactly.
On either side, and that those who are in favor of a reasonable solution, that they do put that in front, mm-hmm. put violence, ignore it.
Put it aside,
exactly, and concentrate on the positive.
Exactly, because clearly violence is never the answer.
Nope.
And so I think that's about it. I would like to thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your opinion with me on this very sensitive subject. And thank you so much for listening.
Welcome, and thank you for inviting, and thanks for listening.
So now that we've discussed the basics of the conflict and how it got to that point, I would like to talk about the international law, because I do think it's an important aspect of the whole conflict and to understand the humanitarian laws better. So I will talk about two international laws that are not respected on both sides by the Israelis and the Palestinians. The first international law that I would like to talk about is the violations of the right to life. Israeli soldiers, police, and security guards have unlawfully killed and injured many Palestinian civilians in the OPT, including during protests against the confiscation of the land and the construction of the settlements. UN agencies and fact-finding missions have also expressed concern about violence perpetrated by a minority of Israeli settlers aimed at intimidating Palestinian populations. And as for the Palestinians, there have been many cases of rock throwings, attacking Israelis, civilians, and also settlers, and just in general not having peace on both sides. For the second international law, I would like to talk about the violations of the rights of freedom and expression and peaceful assembly. Amnesty International has documented Israel's use of military orders to prohibit peaceful protests and criminalize freedom of expression in the West Bank. Israeli forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets, and occasionally live rounds to suppress peaceful protests. As for both sides, there have been no peaceful lives and no peace agreements. There have also been international laws that have not been respected by the Israeli side, such as violations of the rights of the child and collective punishment. Every year, 500 to 700 Palestinian children from the occupied West Bank are prosecuted in Israeli juvenile military courts under Israeli military orders. They are often arrested in night raids and systematically ill-treated. Some of these children serve their sentences with Israel in violation of the 4th Geneva Convention. The UN has also documented that many children have been killed or injured in settler attacks. International humanitarian law posits that no person may be punished for acts that he or she did not commit. It ensures that the collective punishment of a group of persons for a crime committed by an individual is also forbidden, whether in the case of prisoners of war or of any other individuals. As for the second violation, it's the violations of the right to water, electricity, medical supplies, and food. Most Palestinian communities in Area C are not connected to the water network and are prevented from repairing or constructing wells or water cisterns that hold rainwater. Water consumption in some Area C communities is reported by the UN to be 20% of the minimum recommended by standard. Israel's failure to ensure Palestinian residents have a sufficient supply of clean, safe water for drinking and other domestic uses constitutes a violation of its obligations to respect and fulfill the right to water. As for the Palestinian side, we're going to talk about Hamas, because they have committed also war crimes, such as thousands witnessed a massacre at an Israeli music festival where Hamas fighters killed at least 260 people and took captives back into Gaza. About 3,500 young people attended the Supernova music festival, which became one of the first targets of Palestinian gunmen who breached Gaza's border fence early on Saturday from Gaza, 7th October. Many of the fighters, who also arrived in trucks, were wearing body armor and AK-47 assault rifles and rocket grenades. This attack is believed to be the worst civilian massacre in Israeli history. So, das war mit der ersten Episode von unserem Podcast International Law for Peace. Vielmals merci für die Nolauschtren. Und zu dem heutigen Podcast, zu der ersten Episode, könnt ihr nur an eure Klasse rein Flyer finden. Und dort drüber ist ein QR-Code. Und ich möchte mir wünschen, dass ihr da eher froh stellt zu dem Podcast, für das wir die dann zusammen an den nächsten kommenden Episoden beantworten können. Und ich darin dann eine Antwort, ob ihr froh kriegt. Vielmals merci.